In the first hour today, we'll be talking about recent events in Pakistan. More than 130 people were killed last week in Pakistan as suicide bombers targeted opposition leader Benazir. She was in the country for the first time, imposed exile of 8 years. The country has been in some tumult now for months, much of it surrounding the stated intention of the country's president, who is also the head of the military, General Pervez Musharraf, to stand again for re-election. He has been head of the government ever since taking power in 2001. This morning in this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about what has been going on recently in Pakistan and about both the return of Benazir Bhutto to Pakistan and this continuing dispute over General Musharraf's bid to remain in power. And our guest for the program is Sumit Ganguly. He holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's also a member of Indiana's Political Science Faculty, as well as Director of the India Studies Program. He has previously had been a professor of Asian Studies and Government at University of Texas at Austin, also taught political science at Hunter College of City University of New York, and also taught at James Madison College at Michigan State University. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London, and has been following politics in both India and Pakistan for some time and has written a number of books on the subject. Questions are welcome as we talk here on the show. The number, if you'd like to call in, and if you're in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if people have questions, comments, certainly you're welcome to call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many callers as possible and keep things moving along. But again, certainly, your participation is welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Ganguly, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thank you for talking with us once again.
My pleasure entirely.
I guess perhaps we could begin here with the controversy surrounding President Musharraf, his intention to stand again for another term as president. He apparently now has won a vote. The way this works is there is a vote in the parliament, the nation's parliament, and in some regional assemblies, and he won. However, as I understand it, this is still up in the air because of this long-running kind of controversy, debate over his status both as head of the government and head of the military. Where exactly does this stand now?
Well, it stands really with the Pakistani Supreme Court. They have to pass down a judgment on this because there are a number of petitions challenging General Musharraf's election precisely on the grounds that you have pointed out, that he has not shed his military uniform while remaining president. And also, there is a legal. There's another legal element which suggests that anyone holding a particular office will have to step down first from that office before again running for office. And General Musharraf has not. So there is a legal barrier, but General Musharraf has ignored that thus far. And furthermore, the election by the parliament and the various regional assemblies is also politically quite fraught because the way these assemblies and the parliament was constituted left something to be desired. The election that took place was problematic in that the two major political parties, the Pakistan People's Party and the Pakistan Muslim League, were really crippled before the election. And consequently, their numbers in the regional assemblies and the national parliament were considerably diminished. And thereby, General Musharraf essentially has handpicked people who in turn then legitimized his election.
Mm. So in going into this election, there was the argument on one side. Many people said if General Musharraf was going to stand again, he should first resign his post as head of the army. He himself said, well, if what I'm going to do is I'm going to stand, and then if I'm elected afterwards, then I will resign my post in the army.
That's exactly what he said.
And now, does anyone really believe, well, depending on how this gets worked out, does anyone really believe that, in fact, he would do that?
Well, that's an open question, whether or not he would do that. But even if he were to do that, he would carefully ensure, and he has already ensured, that he has someone who will step into his shoes as Chief of Army Staff, someone who is a hand-picked successor who is basically going to do his bidding.
And I expect that probably there are certainly people in the opposition in Pakistan that wouldn't have been are not happy with him continuing to be president, whether he's head of the military or not.
Oh, that's exactly right. There are people within the opposition in Pakistan who are deeply unhappy, regardless of how he continues. That's precisely the case.
Mm-hmm. Let's then shift a little bit and talk about Benazir Bhutto. She is the leader of the Pakistan People's Party, the important opposition force in Pakistan. She had been gone for a long time, and there was this cloud over her of charges of corruption. There, in the run-up to her coming back, she appeared again. She was doing a lot of interviews. There was a lot of talk about what was going on. And were there some kind of negotiations going on between Ms. Bhutto and General Musharraf that would allow her to come back and become involved in politics again? What, if anything, do we know about whatever kind of agreement was worked out between Ms. Bhutto and the General Musharraf?
Well, what we do know based upon the public record is that the charges against her, charges of corruption, would essentially be dropped, and that she would be allowed to participate in the political process. And this is exactly what she wanted. It's not entirely clear if the charges against her husband, who was widely known as Pakistan as Mr. 10%, for his propensity to skim off 10% of any government contract. He was also a minister in her cabinet, and his reputation for corruption and malfeasance is nothing short of legendary. It's not entirely clear what's going to happen to him. He still remains in exile. He has not returned home. But basically, for her, the two critical things was, one, the corruption charges against her would be dismissed, and secondly, she would be allowed to enter the political process.
And there was some speculation, at least according to what I read, that it would not have been impossible for her not only just to become involved in politics again, but to possibly once again become prime minister.
Oh, that's exactly right. Yes, the deal is that, yes, she could become prime minister, not just enter the political process, but she could, once again return to the prime ministership. Mm-hmm. That is exactly right.
Well, if we set aside the fact that there are a lot of people who aren't interested in seeing her involved in politics again and don't wish her well, to say the least, what would a government like that look like with her as prime minister and General Musharraf remaining as president?
Well, basically, this would not be my favorite form of representative government. This is something, this is basically a contrivance. And unfortunately, it has the blessings of the Bush administration, which is under considerable pressure to live up to its stated goal of promoting democracy. And this is a wonderful way of providing a certain kind of gloss on General Musharraf's regime. Basically, the privileges of the military would remain untouched. The military would remain essentially, to use a Latin expression, it's called primus inter pares, first amongst equals. It would do very little, in effect, to transform the military character of the regime. But at least at a public relations level, it would give it a nice appearance, because here you have an articulate woman in the Muslim world who is also the prime minister of an important Muslim country, which is an ally of the United States, at least notionally an ally of the United States. And so at least for appearances' sake, this would look very good. But in practical terms, it would change very, very little in Pakistan.
What do we know about what kind of role the Bush administration indeed played, or did indeed the administration play a role in brokering this deal between Ms. Bhutto and General Musharraf?
There is little or no question in my mind. And this is not merely on the basis of inference and speculation, but this is on the basis of a number of newspaper reports where anonymous spokespersons for the administration have admitted that they played an important role in brokering this deal. That we do not know who were the specific individuals involved in crafting this deal, but there is no question in my mind that the administration has played an important behind-the-scenes role in ensuring her return. I have a strong suspicion that pressure was exerted by Condoleezza Rice, though I do not know this as a matter of certainty, but I cannot imagine that without her playing a role, this would have happened. We do know for a fact that at one point General Musharraf, when feeling particularly besieged, had considered declaring martial law, and it is a matter of record that he was woken up in the middle of the night by Condoleezza Rice and told in the most unequivocal terms that this would damage the relationship with the United States, and this is not something that the U.S. would look upon favorably, and that he should not declare martial law. And from this, it is possible to infer that she probably played an important role in this behind-the-scenes brokering that took place.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Sumit Ganguly, is professor of political science at Indiana University Bloomington, where he's also director of the India Studies Program and has been following politics in India and Pakistan for a long time, has been with us before on the program, and we're pleased that he could be again with us here to talk about current politics in Pakistan and recent events. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I'm sure that people are aware of what occurred last week when Benazir Bhutto came back to Pakistan. She, some of her supporters were moving in a convoy of vehicles through the streets of Karachi. There were a lot of people that turned out to cheer her and to see her. And two bombs went off, and more than something, I'm not sure where the death total stands now, maybe around 140 people were killed. She was not injured, but a lot of people were killed and hurt in this bombing. So raises certainly a question in my mind and in many minds about just what sort of future she has there in Pakistani politics.
Well, a Taliban leader had said that he would be sending in suicide bombers to attack Benazir Bhutto. Whether or not the Taliban was actually involved, it's unclear. There is an allegation that has been made by a senior Pakistani minister that the Al-Qaeda was involved. But that is, of course, a very convenient target to point to, because obviously if one can suggest that the Taliban was involved, then it burnishes Benazir's credentials. And since this statement came from a very senior member of the Musharraf administration, I treat it with a degree of skepticism about the evidence of the Al-Qaeda's involvement. We do not know this for a certainty. We can only rely on the statement made by this senior person. But obviously there's a segment of the population, and there are elements of radical Islamists within Pakistan who do not look upon Benazir's return with any degree of favor or with any degree of warmth. And they obviously will be hostile towards her. But this does not in any way definitively prove that the Al-Qaeda was involved in the assassination attempt.
Mm-hmm. And certainly to be a leader in Pakistan is dangerous. President Musharraf himself survived an attempted assassination in 2003. So I'm sure that no matter who you are, security concerns are significant. Do you think that somehow means that Ms. Bhutto would not be able to have a significant role in Pakistani politics, would not be able to go on to be prime minister, or just one would say, well, that is something that must just be accepted and taken into account. And no matter who you are in Pakistani politics, if you're a high-profile individual, there are risks.
This basically comes with the territory. Given Pakistan's dalliance with radical Islamists, and quite frankly, and this needs to be stated for the record, that Benazir Bhutto herself is hardly innocent in all of this. The Taliban really was nurtured during her regime. There was a minister of the interior, a former military officer, a former general, a man called Nasirullah Babar, who actually used to refer to the Taliban as my children. And so Benazir herself bears a certain responsibility for having bred these groups and these entities within Pakistan and under General Musharraf's regime, despite his putative collaboration with us in the war on terror. He has been quite selective in terms of which groups he has cracked down upon and which groups he has not. And there is ample evidence to suggest that General Musharraf has actually given considerable leeway to the neo-Taliban because it is in his interest, or at least in his perceived interest. He's no fan of the Karzai regime. Pakistan has long dreamt of having a very pliant regime in Afghanistan. They were the ones that were hand in glove with the Taliban. And there is evidence that suggests that they have allowed the Taliban to regroup. And Benazir is hardly innocent of this. Mm-hmm. Today, she is claiming to be this great exemplar of democracy and seeming to embrace the West. But she has a rather unsavory history in the past. And some of this is catching up with her today.
So you were just to underline that there certainly has been and as you say continues to be support for Taliban by elements within the Pakistani government and no doubt within the Pakistani military that goes back to this desire to have a regime in Afghanistan that would be that they could have some control over. Given that, can you talk a little bit more about relations between now the government of that is in place in Afghanistan with the government of Pakistan? That must certainly, President Karzai and his government must know full well about Pakistan's previous involvement and current involvement with the Taliban. That must not sit very well with them in Afghanistan.
No, most certainly it does not. And the relationship has been downright frosty, despite the rather contrived smiles and the shaking of hands for the benefit of television cameras between Karzai and Musharraf. Karzai, on occasion, has made clear his unhappiness about the repeated raids that have taken place from within Pakistan into Afghan territory, the continuance of the Taliban within Pakistani territory, and the relationship has not been an especially warm one. And here, actually, India is somewhat implicated in that India is a staunch supporter of the Karzai regime. Karzai spent a substantial amount of his earlier years in India, has a fondness for India. India has spent close to $1 billion in the reconstruction of Afghanistan. It's the second largest aid donor after the United States in the post-Taliban era. And there is intense Indian and Pakistani competition for influence within Afghanistan. And Pakistan, ever since its breakup in 1971, has felt that Afghanistan would give it strategic depth. This is a term that Pakistani generals have coined to suggest that in the event of a future war with India, that if India pressed them especially hard, they could always sort of fall back into Afghanistan. Hence the notion of strategic depth. And to have strategic depth, you need a pliant regime in Afghanistan, and one that is not especially sympathetic to India, like the Karzai regime.
We're getting very close to the midpoint here. And again, I just would like to invite people who are listening. If you have questions, you can certainly call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We're talking about current events in Pakistan with Shumit Ganguly. He's professor of political science at Indiana University. Benazir Bhutto has been a prime minister. It looks like perhaps might be prime minister again, and it certainly might want to argue that that politics is in her blood. It's her birthright. Her father had led the government before until he was swept from power by a military coup, and he was later executed. So I guess one wouldn't really be surprised that she would want to have some continued involvement in the politics of Pakistan. But having said that, one wonders just what it is that is driving her. Do you feel that you have some kind of insight?
Oh, absolutely. Part of what you say is absolutely correct. I mean, she entered politics in the wake of her father's death and after the military regime of General Ziaul Haq came to a close in 1988. She returned to a triumphal welcome. She won hands down in an election which was widely considered to be free and fair. But then she proceeded to squander that extraordinary mandate that she had garnered, in part because of widespread sympathy for her father, because she was a woman in a male-dominated society, who had dared to actually enter the political fray, and thirdly, because people were tired of the very dark years of General Zia's regime and the repression that had taken place under the regime, and there was a yearning for a degree of political freedom, and consequently, here was a charismatic young woman whose father had been executed by the military, and so she had won quite handsomely. But then, as I say, she proceeded to completely squander and fritter away that mandate. Why has she returned? Well, what else is she going to do? She could live the life of a socialite, I suppose, in the West. She has enough wealth squirreled away to live quite comfortably till the end of her days and then some. She has considerable wealth and land in Pakistan. She comes from landed gentry in the southern province of Sindh. This is ultimately her homeland. And once you have been a head of state, once you've been in the fray of politics, it really does enter your blood. And it's very difficult to live a quiet existence in some rural community outside London where she owns considerable property. Mm. It's rather hard to retreat to that kind of existence indefinitely.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that she and her party seem to have worked out an understanding with General Musharraf in part because of pressure from the United States that she agreed that she and her party would not stand in the way of his standing again for re-election. They would not oppose it, and that on the other side, he apparently would see that these corruption charges against her would go away, make it possible for her to come back and to get involved in politics again. I'm sure that there must be some people in the opposition in Pakistan who would not be happy with her for having made that deal with the general. Does that pose any kind of problem, a political problem for her?
Oh, of course it does. The supporters of Nawaz Sharif, who are not inconsiderable, the leader of the other major political party, who was a major industrialist in the Punjab, who ironically had been thrust into politics by the Pakistani military initially when they wanted to have a kind of a civilian facade. And they had used him, but then he, once in office, he started to display a degree of independence and started to curb the powers of the military and, most importantly, the powers of the presidency. And that's when they managed to get him deposed. Well, his supporters, who are not trivial, will obviously be unhappy and remain unhappy because He's been sent back into exile into Saudi Arabia, and there is simmering discontent amongst those groups.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting story there. He, like Benazir Bhutto, was facing charges of corruption. Like her, tried to return to the country, but he was only in Pakistan for a few hours, I think. Essentially, they kept him confined and then, after a short while, put him on a plane and sent him back out of Pakistan again.
Yes, they gave him a choice of either, it was kind of a Hobson's choice, either go back to Saudi Arabia or face corruption charges, and we're going to put you in this notorious prison called Attock Fort, where there have been allegations of torture and beatings of political prisoners, not a particularly savory prospect for Nawaz Sharif. And he can count his blessings, I suppose, that, you know, they didn't move to execute him as they did with Benazir Bhutto's father. He was dispatched fairly quickly, as you correctly point out, within a few hours.
Well, let's just again talk about where things stand here now. The presidential election took place. At least the national parliament and the provincial assemblies voted for General Musharraf to be reelected as president. And this is now the outcome here is uncertain because the Supreme Court has to rule on whether or not he was even eligible to stand because he continued to be the head of the military, continued to hold his post as the general and head of the military. So that's sort of up in the air. The general himself had said before that if he was reelected, he would then resign his post in the military. So one doesn't know about that. One doesn't quite know about how things are likely to be worked out between the general and Mrs. Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party. Do you have some sense on exactly how all of these unresolved questions will get resolved?
No. I mean, it's all really up in the air at the moment. It much depends on what the Supreme Court decides. It depends upon how General Musharraf responds. He's already, by the way, hinted that he may not abide by the Supreme Court's judgment. It was a very carefully crafted remark that he stated. He said that let's just see what the Supreme Court says, and then we will decide. Which was a really intriguing remark.
Do you have any sense of what the timeline is here? When something might happen? When, for example, the Supreme Court might make some kind of decision?
Oh, the Supreme Court's decision is expected almost imminently. I mean, I think it's within the next month or so.
Let me ask you about something else. This is going back now to the spring. This was at the point where there was emerged a public kind of conflict between General Musharraf and the Chief Justice of Pakistan's Supreme Court, Iftikhar Chaudhry. And what was interesting here is that, I guess previously, the Supreme Court seemed to essentially go along with anything that the general wanted. It was not a body that you would think was going to challenge the president. But what happened here was apparently for some reason General Musharraf decided he wanted to go after Mr. Chief Justice Chaudhry, and that then the Chief Justice decided that he was going to stand up to the general, and as a result became something of a hero for the political opposition in the country, which it seemed kind of surprising given the fact that, as I say, that previously the Supreme Court, they didn't look like they were likely to challenge the general. And one wondered what exactly motivated Mr. Chaudhry, the Chief Justice of the court, to stand up to the general in the way that he did.
Yes, it's not entirely clear what prompted the Chief Justice to do this, but the fight between the Chief Justice and General Musharraf stemmed from the fact that the Chief Justice had raised certain rather uncomfortable questions about a number of people who have been picked up by Pakistan's intelligence services and have, in effect, disappeared. This is something that happened under various Latin American dictatorships, where opponents of the regime, people accused of various kinds of crimes, were not really produced in court, but were picked up by intelligence services, and then they disappeared, and frequently, summarily executed. And the Chief Justice had raised awkward questions about this, because a very substantial number of people have met this fate, and their fate is uncertain, it's unclear. And this had basically generated General Musharraf's ire against the Chief Justice. And much to his surprise, the Chief Justice garnered widespread support not only amongst the populace of Pakistan, but more importantly, amongst the lawyers who, at some risk to their personal lives and their professional lives, stepped out into the streets. I mean, there was this peculiar sight of these lawyers clad in their very formal gowns and clothes, basically picking up rocks and hurling them at the police. It's not a sight that one sees in Pakistan or, frankly, in any other part of the world.
And did that, I suppose that might have given the general some sense of urgency, in addition, as we said, to the kind of pressure coming from the United States to see if he could work out some kind of deal with Mrs. Bhutto. Because at the time, there was fairly significant anti-government protest going on.
Oh, I completely agree. I think that's precisely what concentrated his mind. I think he was taken aback by the level of hostility the level of hostility that was generated in the wake of these these demonstrations. He did not think the demonstrations would last as long as they did, that they would acquire the degree of popular support that they garnered. I think that these events played a vitally important role in concentrating his mind.
Well, we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I guess we just would like to introduce once again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Sumit Ganguly, he is professor of political science at Indiana University at Bloomington, where he is also director of the India Studies Program. He's also taught at University of Texas Austin, at Hunter College of the City University of New York, and at James Madison College at Michigan State. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. He's also been a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington, D.C., and at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford. He's written a number of books having to do with India and Pakistan, including Conflict Unending, India-Pakistan Tensions Since 1947, and The Crisis in Kashmir, Portents of War, Hopes of Peace. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If you take a look at the political agendas, say the political agenda of the Pakistan People's Party and what they would like to achieve in Pakistan, how they would like to see the country governed, and then also take a look at the political agenda of the current government and of the president, General Musharraf, what would one say were the most important agenda items? I mean, what are the significant problems within Pakistan that they feel that the government needs to take on? And then do they have very different, would their approach to solving those problems be very different?
Boy, where does one begin with the problems facing Pakistan? The list is virtually endless. The most important problem, I think, facing Pakistan is the almost near complete breakdown of political and social institutions within Pakistan. The only two institutions that are still working, one is the military, the other is the civil service, but the civil service is almost completely under the thumb of the military. Ironically enough, the one other institution that does work in Pakistan, but whose influence I think is extremely limited, is the English language press. For reasons that I think are quite clear, General Musharraf, for the most part, has left the English language press alone because it enables him to go abroad and point out and say, look, you know, this is one of the most important features of a working democracy, and look how vital the English language press is in this country. But the English language press reaches a minuscule segment of Pakistan's population. They really all know one another, in effect. And this is a convenient ploy of General Musharraf. And even then, with the press, on occasion when the press has got crossed what some of my Pakistani friends call certain invisible lines, he has not been above cracking down on them, and rather brutally. So to begin with, to go back to my central point, that there is virtually a complete breakdown of institutions in Pakistan. So one will have to sort of renew these institutions. The judiciary has shown remarkable strength in recent years, which is a very hopeful sign for Pakistan. But let's talk about other institutions, for example. Schooling in Pakistan has virtually disappeared. And in its place, it has been replaced by all manner of these Islamic schools called madrasas, where children are exposed mostly to rote learning and rote learning of the Quran. And this is probably in some of the better madrasas. Some of the other madrasas teach a kind of virulent hatred of the West. Their curricula are downright obscurantist. So we are talking about a complete breakdown of the educational system within Pakistan, particularly primary education, which has such a large impact for the future of the country. The breakdown of things like elementary services, like healthcare in Pakistan. So the challenges are myriad and just literally boundless. We are really talking about building institutions from the ground up.
One of the overarching issues that certainly concerns people who follow politics in West Asia is the relationship between Pakistan and India. They have, after all, fought two wars, and the level of concern was ratcheted up considerably some years ago when both countries demonstrated the capability for building nuclear weapons. And there was a real concern at one point that if the two countries should go to war again, there would be the possibility that nuclear weapons would be used. So the idea of managing on both sides, I'm sure, in the government of India and the government of Pakistan, the approach to managing this relationship is extremely important. They're talking, but perhaps not. It's not perhaps what a lot of people would like it to be. Can you talk a little bit about just, again, now where things stand in this relationship, the relationship between the two governments?
The relationship right now is probably better than it has been in a long time. Unfortunately, not much movement is taking place because Pakistan is, and General Musharraf is, so consumed with trying to bring some semblance of order to domestic priorities. And as a consequence, while there have been no major incidents in the past 6 months involving militants who might have carried out attacks against India on Indian soil emanating from Pakistan. Nevertheless, there is very little progress in terms of an improvement in relations, for the simple reason the Indians have adopted a watch-and-wait strategy, and Pakistan right now at this stage is not in a position to deliver anything because General Musharraf is so utterly preoccupied with conditions at home. The domestic scene is so fraught that for him to be able to devote significant energies towards an improvement of relations with India is simply asking the impossible.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Pakistan and the concerns that a lot of people have about Islamist groups that are active there. And I'm thinking about, for example, someone who, and one of my colleagues who knew that we were going to have this conversation this morning, just the other day comes over to me and tosses down in front of me the most recent copy of Newsweek magazine. And perhaps people have seen this on the front. And it's a story about politics in Pakistan. And what it says right on the cover is the most dangerous nation in the world isn't Iraq. It clearly they think that it is Pakistan. Now, certainly, this is something that concerns the United States. The United States considers Pakistan to be an important partner in what it calls the war on terror. But it seems that sometimes that what the government of Pakistan is doing is walking a very narrow line, trying on the one hand to do what it must to satisfy the United States, and yet not do anything that would further anger Islamists in Pakistan that could indeed pose a significant threat to the government. What can one say about those kinds of concerns about Pakistan and militant Islam?
Well, unfortunately, the best way to describe General Musharraf's policy has been to hunt with the hounds and run with the hares. In many ways, has given considerable leeway to radical Islamists within Pakistan as long as they direct their fire to towards two entities. One is Kashmir, the other is Afghanistan. But he has, to his credit, delivered on some al-Qaeda operatives who were within Pakistan and the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, Pakistan's extraordinarily powerful in military intelligence agency, which has powers of both domestic enforcement and, of course, can run various kinds of foreign operations, particularly directed against India and Afghanistan, and, of course, has extensive contacts with radical Islamists, was deeply in bed with the Taliban. So there is, it's very much a Janus-faced policy. On certain issues, he has allowed a degree of cooperation, but on the other hand, his cooperation has been hobbled because his interests are contradictory. On the one hand, he obviously wants to come across as a friend of the West and as an ally of the West and as an ally of the United States, and he has an interest in containing al-Qaeda. But he has little or no interest in containing the Taliban or in containing the various Islamist groups who are operating within Pakistan and seeking to destabilize and wreak havoc in Indian-controlled Kashmir. So it's very much a bifurcated policy. That's the best way to describe it.
And, well, is do Islamists in Pakistan pose some sort of threat outside of the region? Now, that would be enough. We don't want regional instability here, for at least in part for the reasons that we've talked about. I guess I just wonder, again, going back to that kind of thing like the Newsweek cover, which I'm sure sells magazines, but the question in my mind is, well, just what exactly, in what way does Pakistan pose some sort of potential risk more than just regional?
Oh, it poses a danger well beyond the region for the simple reason that one can make an analytic distinction between the Taliban and the al-Qaeda. But for all practical purposes, we need to bear in mind that there are organic links between the al-Qaeda and the Taliban. These are not exactly completely disparate entities. They share personnel, they share goals, they share ideas. Remember that Osama bin Laden was hosted by the Taliban. It's in their bosom that he was living, and arguably, very possibly, continues to do so in this netherworld along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I'm not sure whether Pakistani intelligence is aware of his whereabouts, certainly I don't. They have demonstrated any great alacrity in trying to track him down. So there is little question that these groups pose well beyond the region. The threat they pose within the region is dangerous enough, but we would be foolish if we were to believe that this is in any way confined to the region. The threats that they pose extend well beyond the region, and we should be acutely cognizant of that.
Well, let's talk with a caller in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
David, I just came in on the conversation, and so I may cover things that you have discussed with your guests. My question is, I understand the United States engineered the return of former Prime Minister Bhutto to Pakistan, I guess, to have a joint government with the current Prime Minister. My question to you is that true, and to what degree would the United States consider that type of joint power sharing in its interests?
Well, we did talk about that a little bit earlier, but I have no problem with recapping, because I think it's certainly an important question. Professor Ganguly?
The hope is that this would ultimately help engineer a more full transition to democracy. But I think this is a rather forlorn hope. First of all, I think Benazir is acutely beholden at this point to General Musharraf. There is nothing in her background that shows that she has the either the mental capacity or the personal integrity to stand up to the military. General Musharraf is not going to go gently into the night. And consequently, I think we are again making a huge mistake in terms of allying ourselves with a rather unpopular military dictator and a political leader who has made essentially a rather Faustian bargain with this military leader. And I don't think this is a wise move on our part.
Okay, and my last question is, the recent assassination attempt on former Prime Minister Bhutto, do you know or have suspects who may have been behind that? And if anything, did President Musharraf tacitly approve of that?
I doubt that he would tacitly approve of this, for the simple reason that he needs Benazir at this point to have a civilian facade for his regime. It would not be in his interest to try and see her blown up just as she landed, because his options at this point are not exactly exemplary. He has limited options, and he needs her at this particular historical moment. My suspicion is that any number of people, any number of Islamist groups who don't particularly like the idea of a woman prime minister, and these groups have proliferated and have thrived in the last decade or so within Pakistan, were responsible. The Taliban had previously said that they would attack her, and they didn't claim responsibility after the attack, but I wouldn't put it past them.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Not at all.
That certainly is something that I was curious about. That is the role that her being a woman would play in motivating people who would want to attack her. And one wonders whether if we changed nothing else about her, gave her the same political resume, the same political agenda, but she was a man, whether she would have been as much of a target.
No, probably not. She probably would not be as much of a target. She would nevertheless be a target, given the kind of view that person would represent and that position that person would represent, and also given, above all, the link with the United States. That has become a lightning rod, and we cannot get away from that. That anyone who is seen as being foisted by the United States. Anyone who's seen is who is going to be seen as being someone being brought to Pakistan with the blessings of the United States automatically has a curse on his or her head. This is a kind of an ironic blessing.
Well, we're at the point here where we're going to have to finish up. We've used our time. We want to say thanks to our guest, Sumit Ganguly. He holds the Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, Bloomington, where he's a member of Indiana's political science faculty as well as the director of the India Studies Program, and has been following politics in India and also in Pakistan for some time now, and has written a number of books, particularly about conflict between India and Pakistan and about the crisis of Kashmir. So if you're interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for his books. Professor Ganguly, thank you very much.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you for having me on your show.